Cumberland traffic, code point 4041 uniform, departing 11 right hand turn.
And so I was still just kind of hanging on, trying to figure out how to put it in and not get blown over the back of this mountain safely. And an eagle came out of a tree and just skied out, just poof. And I went to where he was or had just been and got a ripper thermal. You know, it was like a 12 meter climb. Lost one side of my wing, but that didn't matter because the thermal was so strong. And I went to 16,000 feet in what felt like seconds.
This is Soaring the Sky, a glider pilot's podcast, coming to you from the Mid-Atlantic region here in the United States and bringing you great soaring content from glider pilots all over the globe. We now join Chuck and our guest pilot.
Thank you, Michelle. Always appreciate your help here on the podcast. And thank you for joining us for another great guest and more adventures. Today, we will be getting a different view of the skies. I thought it'd be fun to hear what it's like soaring in a thermal in a paraglider. And who better to explain how it works and share his soaring journey with us than Gavin McClurg. Now, Gavin is a paraglider pilot, an author, an adventurer, a public speaker, and he is also a host of the podcast Cloud Base Mayhem. I'm sure some of you have heard that podcast. Now, he has flown in Alaska, being the first person to traverse the full length of the Alaska Range by foot and paraglider. He became the first American to compete in the toughest adventure race on Earth. That's the X Alps. I'll put some links in the show notes for a couple YouTube videos. Absolutely mind-blowing what you even have to do to compete in that event. Gavin shares a lot of those stories with us. I'm excited to hear about that. I know you're going to love this. Later on this episode, Sergio is back. He has a brand new segment called Cloud Flying. So get ready, strap on the harness. Going to do some paragliding with Gavin. Hello, Gavin. Welcome to Soaring the Sky.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here, Chuck. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah. So paragliding, you know, it's not something we usually do. You know, we're all about sailplanes. But I was like, you know, I really got to talk to some of these paraglider guys. And I've been watching you the past couple of years on your podcast. And I thought it'd be super interesting for us glider pilots to just to get another perspective.
Yeah, I need to do the same. I had a guy, Kevin Brooker, on the show a while back. It was one of my most popular shows. He's a sailplane pilot back east, north of you. And we were talking a lot about WAVE and the Purland Project and just some of the things going on in the sailplane world. I need to get a lot more on, because my show does definitely do more paragliding than anything else, but it's really a free flight show. So I need to, you know, and soaring and sailplanes are, you know, the original beast, and and they're amazing. And I always feel like, God, there's so much that we could learn from sailplane pilots. So yeah, excited to have this talk with you.
Yeah. I kind of feel the same way about you guys. So much to learn. So gliders have a cockpit with the usual controls, and our listeners are familiar with that. What various lines are you guys tugging on, and what function do they have for what situation?
Yeah, we really only have two methods of controlling speed, and that's our brakes. So our hands are through our brake lines, which on the right hand goes to the right cascade of brake lines, which is at the tailing edge of the wing. So just imagine an airplane with flaps down, and the left hand goes to the left side. And so that's really how we can slow the wing down. And then we control pitch and roll and yaw and everything with weight shift. And we also have in our legs can activate a speed bar, which depending on the harness, you know, for cross country flying, we're typically in kind of a cocoon, and we can step. Typically a step has one or two steps in it. Two or three steps in it. And you can speed the wing up, you know, increase the angle of attack by adding more speed bar. So those are really the only two things we can do in terms of, you know, slowing her down or speeding her up. So if you're increasing your angle of attack, of course, it's just like you guys putting the nose down, you're speeding up, but your glide ratio is going down.
Right. So our producer, Mitch, in Southern California there, he was wondering why they see parapilots flying in the San Gabriels, but usually only during the very peak strong months of August and September, and always with days of some development or cumulus clouds, never really on blue days. He was always curious about that, even on blue days with like the 10 knot thermals topping out at maybe 10 to 12,000 feet. He said they never really see paragliders.
Yeah, I read your question, you know, yesterday, and so the peak season out there really is quite a bit before then, and so it might just be a matter of when you guys are flying versus I would think it'd be the same, but you know the really good season, especially at Marshall, is earlier. So most of the people start wandering out there. I mean, there's a pretty good year-round scene in Marshall for hang gliding and paragliding, but a lot of my friends that are really keen and they travel year-round to fly will get out to Marshall in kind of April, May, and so they're earlier, but certainly we don't shy away at all from blue days. So that was surprising to me to hear that they're not seeing paragliders on blue days. My guess is maybe that we have to remember that we don't like wind, and you guys can handle a lot more wind than we do. So what might be a, you know, quote unquote light wind day for a sailplane might just be too strong for us. You know, we often fly in the Mojave. We launch off the east side, on the backside of Marshall and stuff, and we'll fly out in the Mojave and get really tall, as I know the sailplanes do as well. But we can handle more wind in those kind of places because you don't have the rotor. You know, you can escape out into the desert and you don't have all the terrain. But when there's terrain, you know, anything much over 15K an hour starts to get pretty rowdy for us. You know, we will fly certainly in more than that, up to maybe 30K an hour in the mountains, but then it starts to get pretty dicey. So my guess is, you know, we're out there and maybe the sailplanes just aren't seeing them. They're taking different routes or different times. But, you know, I know August, September starts to get really stable in that part of the world. And that's when a lot of the paragliders are out in the desert, you know, chasing higher bases and bigger distance.
Yeah, I mean, you're super light. I can't imagine. I've flown some of the pretty light gliders and I get in some turbulence. I'm getting bounced around. I just can't imagine you guys getting tossed around in something so light. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I can't compare it, of course, because I've never flown a sailplane. A lot of paragliders do fly sailplanes, and so they'd be better to ask when it comes to that. But I would imagine we're taking a little bit more of a beating than you guys do, for sure.
Yeah. And just a straight up cruise glide, what kind of glide slope is typical in a paraglider? I mean, I know a sailplane pilots were used to 30 to 1 to up to 50 to 1.
Yeah, I mean, our baseline's about 10 to 1. You know, it used to be quite a bit worse than that. You know, certainly our high-end, what we call hot gliders, competition gliders, are up there in the kind of 11.5, pushing into 12 to 1. But in terms of what we think of, you know, when we're looking at our polars, we're thinking 10 to 1 is a pretty good scenario if, you know, all things equal. You know, we are very affected by the wind. So obviously a little bit of headwind, that goes way down. A little bit of tailwind, it goes way up. So these days, the competition gliders, the two-liners, you know, there was a huge step forward in glider technology when Ozone invented the two-liner. We call it the shark nose. So instead of the top surface and the bottom surface just being completely open in front, these days the top surface bends all the way around. The intake, I guess you'd call it, is very narrow, and it's on the bottom surface of the glider. And so that was just a huge step forward in terms of reducing drag with the two-liner technology, but also just increasing speed and glide. And so, and therefore glide. And so we, you know, the top end competition gliders, which are of course more dangerous to fly because they're just much, much higher aspect. You know, think of it just a really high aspect sailplane where you're starting to get to the 60 to one, they're touching the kind of mid-range hang gliders, you know, so that's, they're well over even, I believe, even 12 to 1. So, you know, still remarkably slow and a very poor glide compared to you guys. But pretty exciting for us.
Oh, yeah. I was watching some of the videos there, and it looks like you guys are just, like, hovering. It's wild, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when we're... you know, when we're ridge soaring or, you know, at a, at an ocean site and just ridge soaring, if there's, you know, if there's 20, 30 K an hour wind, you're basically parked, you know, you're just chilling
yeah,
out.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, our trim speed on a high end glider, you know, so no speed bar, just trim, is going to be in the kind of mid 40s K an hour. And on those hot end gliders, which are pretty exciting to fly and a lot of fun. And, you know, when you're on full speed, you're up around 70 K an hour. So there's a huge difference between trim and full speed, but yeah, it's still, again, it's just totally different ball game than a sailplane.
You had kind of mentioned this actually to kind of answer the question, but just soaring around Instagram, I rarely see any cross-pollination between sailplane pilots and parapilots. And you said you do know some other pilots that also fly gliders, but is that common in a lot of paraglider pilots? Or do a lot of them do fly gliders, or what have you seen?
I wouldn't say a lot. You know, I thought about this. I know less than a handful who do personally. There's one of my ex-Alps buddies, Nick Nannens from New Zealand, has just recently gotten into soaring, and there's certainly more in Europe. We have a very famous hang glider pilot who has the world record that he broke in 2012, a guy named Dustin Martin, who lives down in Arizona, and he got his start in sailplanes. I don't think he flies them much anymore.
Okay.
So there certainly is. You know, I think it's, when it comes down to it, what I've heard is that it's quite a bit different sensation and it's quite a bit different type of flying. I mean, the principle is exactly the same, of course, but it's a much different texture. It's a much different aesthetic in a sense because we're, you know, we don't have a cockpit. We don't have anything protecting us. There's a lot more sound and, like I said, a lot more rowdiness. And so my guess, I don't have any statistics behind this, but my guess is, you know, a lot of paraglider pilots, as they start aging out, they're probably getting more into soaring, or it becomes a more attractive thing because, you know, paragliding is, can tend to be pretty hard on us, landing. And, you know, if you, when you start getting more brittle in older age, then, you know, I think flying a sailplane is definitely going to be safer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you guys are athletes. I mean, that's kind of how I look at it. You pretty much have to be.
It's becoming more that way. You know, when I first got into the sport kind of in the early 2000s, I certainly didn't hear that word being thrown around very much. And you saw a lot of people who were not very fit in the sport because you don't have to be. You certainly don't have to be. You can drive up to launch and, you know, the actual art of flying doesn't require a ton of, you know, physical energy. It requires, like you guys, a ton of brain energy. You're burning a lot of calories. And there's, of course, you know, on rowdy days, there's a lot of fear and there's just a lot going on. So you are burning a lot of calories, but it doesn't, the flying aspect doesn't necessarily require a really high level of fitness. But in the last 15 years with the, you know, the increase, attention and excitement about hike and fly and all the hike and fly races that are happening around the world, you know, that's become a big part of our sport. There's been a huge increase in bivy flying. So that's vol biv is the French term. They invented it, like they invent all the cool things where you're hiking and flying and camping. And so, you know, you can cover huge expanses, big mountain ranges if you have the time to do it and the supplies. And so, you know, quite a few years back, I crossed the Alaskan range. A couple years before that, I crossed the Canadian Rockies down to the U.S. border. You know, these were big. The Alaska one was 37 days.
Oh, wow.
And so there's a huge interest in that. When I first got into Volbiv, yeah, there was a handful of people doing it, and now it's become really popular. And just by nature, you've got to be fit to do that because you're carrying not only your gear, but your food and your tent and, you know, all the stuff you need to survive for multiple days. So, and then there's been a big push for, you know, to go big, you know, to send big lines and to fly big distances that require 9, 10, 11 hours in the sky. You've just got to be fit. You've got to be well rested, and physical fitness does play a huge factor in success there. So it's really turned quite a bit since I've gotten into it that, you know, these days when you show up at a launch, I would agree with you. Most pilots are pretty fit. Maybe athletes pushing it too far. Certainly many of them are, but I think people are paying attention to staying fit just to keep it more safe. Because the other thing is just durability. You know, when you're fit and spending some time in the gym, that could mean the difference between a hard landing and going to the hospital and a hard landing and just walking away.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just Soaring, the makers of the Glider Sim Pro Sailplane Simulator Cockpit, would like to congratulate German pilot Ben Fest for his recent victory in the first ever FAI-sanctioned aviation esports event in history, the Sailplane World Grand Prix, which Ben won after several days of exciting competition against some of the top Condor Soaring pilots from around the world. If you are looking for a best-in-class dedicated sailplane simulator cockpit for Condor or Microsoft Flight Sim, look no further than the Just Soaring Glider Sim Pro. Check them out at justsoaring.com or at just.soaring on Instagram. I think we've all seen a lot of YouTube and paragliding pilots having some entanglement with maybe a large flying creature, but I'm sure those, you know, most of the time I'm sure they're exceptions, but for the most part, do the big birds play nice with you guys, or do they get freaked out and bothered by your presence? I think for sailplane pilots tucked nicely inside our cockpits, it's mostly not a big thing that we worry about.
Yeah, same. You know, birds are definitely, you know, most of the time they're helping us out. You know, just like you guys, you're looking for birds in a climb, and, you know, if they're out climbing you, you got to go to them. And so we see birds as a huge advantage. You know, we want to see birds, and, you know, that helps us cover distance typically. And, you know, they're always taking the better line. So, and I've heard of almost no incidents. You know, there was a really famous one that's all over YouTube, out in Bir, India, which is a really popular place to paraglide and has become really popular in the last decade. You know, they have big vultures out there, and, you know, it was just I think the lines are pretty hard for a big bird to see, especially from a distance. And this was one of those just super rare cases where, you know, the pilot was flying one direction and the vulture was coming at him, directly at him from the other direction. And as you know, we're not very easy to see when we're head on. That's why we always worry about airplanes. And yeah. So the bird just flew right into the pilot's lines and got totally tangled up, and the pilot had to throw his reserve, and they both came down together, and both the pilot and the bird were totally okay. And the video is hysterical, but I think it was, wow, a Russian pilot, but pretty rare. There's a buddy of mine who was used to be a pilot down in Australia on the Perth side, on the west side. There's I think it's an eagle that is very territorial, and especially if they've got chicks. And this is a place where it's a very popular soaring site, and those pilots often get hit by the eagles. And when I mean get hit, the eagles come down on top of the canopy and just attack it and put big holes in their gliders. As far as I know, no one's ever,
oh, wow.
You can fly a paraglider with a lot of problems. You know, it can have blown out lines. It could have big holes. And it's not as good, but it's still fine. I've had lots of, you know, when we launch our gliders in rocky terrain or with a lot of, you know, a lot of snags and that kind of thing, rather than being on a, you know, quote unquote, tailored launch, or, you know, one that's been like at Marshall, where it's, you're not going to get tangled on anything. You know, when you're doing a lot of hike and flying, a lot of bivvy, you're often getting to launches that are not ideal, and you'll pop a line or something and it's no big deal. You can totally fly your glider with missing lines, but, or holes. It's not a big deal until they get really big. So I've never heard of that actually taking a glider out of the sky. I'm sure I'm sure there's a case, but for the most part, birds are our friends.
That kind of brings me to safety, if we can talk about that for a bit. I think for most glider pilots, they perceive that paragliding is on the risk scale, probably higher risk sports and sailplanes. I'm sure there are some stats out there for fatalities or injuries per 1,000 hours or whatever. But all that aside, what is it that gets parapilots in trouble? I mean, for us glider pilots, it's getting slow in a landing pattern or thermaling, or, you know, flying too close to terrain and stalling. What are the real gotcha things in the para world?
Probably very similar. I'm sure the statistics are worse in paragliding than sailplanes. Maybe that's just numbers. I don't know how many sailplane pilots there are in the world. Do you know? Do you have a number?
I don't have a number right offhand for you.
I can't imagine it's as many. You don't see. I mean, I fly a lot in the Alps. I fly with a lot of sailplanes, but you know, on a big day, I'll see, you know, 10 sailplanes and 150 paragliders and a few hang gliders, you know, so that, I think that's probably pretty representative. You know, if we just expand that out to the world, I would imagine that's pretty close. So it might just be numbers, but I would hazard that the statistics are quite a bit worse in paragliding. And I would hazard that the reasons are very similar. Launching and landing is what gets people. It's very rare that it's something that happens in the sky, at least when there's enough terrain to deal with a problem. But like you said, when you're shallow on the terrain, when you're tight on the terrain, if something happens, you know, you put yourself in the wrong spot or, you know, get hit by a dust devil or, you know, you're lee flying. We do a lot of lee flying, as I know you do as well, but you know, of course, lee flying just puts you in pockets of rotor. And if you mismanage a situation or something that, you know, hits you that you just weren't anticipating and you're low on the terrain, you know, you have very little time to react or do something about it. So, you know, but most of the accidents, and I don't have statistics, but it's going to be way up there in terms of the percentage are, you know, blown landings and blown launches. So launches, typically those are getting plucked, you know, so in conditions that are a little bit strong for that pilot's ability, and they try to launch and it's just too windy or too cross. And then landing is exactly what you said, is speed.
Yeah.
You know, not having enough speed of the glider, getting too deep in the brakes and stalling the whole glider or spinning it, which is stalling one side of the glider, low to the terrain and coming in hard. So a lot of that ends up being from object fixation, just like you guys learn about, and, or just putting it into a tight spot and not nailing it. And then usually panicking and, you know, turning downwind, or instead of crashing into a tree, you know, trying to put it in over a bit of dirt, and whereas the tree would have been a much safer choice, you know, and then again spinning the glider or something. So, you know, our sport sees a lot of ankles and legs and of course spinal injuries.
Oh wow, yeah.
You know, aviation, you don't want to hit the ground.
No.
Or you want to hit the ground softly.
Yeah. As far as thermaling, now, do you guys do the same as gliders as far as turning into the thermals at steep banks, or is it more sheer line and convergence or ridge?
No, it's the same. I can't imagine, even though that I'm not a sailplane pilot, it's the exact same thing. You know, if it's a strong thermal, we're banking harder. If it's a light thermal, we're trying to keep the glider as flat as we possibly can. You know, of course, we're always searching for convergence because we're not as fast as you guys and our glide is not nearly as good. So, you know, if we can get a convergence line, we'll try to take advantage of that the best we can. The distance record was broken this year down in Texas on a paraglider. A guy went 608 kilometers, I think, in a straight line from South Texas to North Texas up over the hill country. And that was possible because of, nice. You know, an incredible convergence line between the dry line that comes over from New Mexico and a system that was out in the Gulf, and the two converged, and, you know, he saw it coming and flew an incredible convergence line where he didn't need to turn, especially near the end of the flight, very much at all. So, you know, we'll seek out convergence lines. We have software that was actually developed by the sailplane pilot down in Australia, that I'm sure most of your pilots use, that, you know, that can help pick out convergence lines. And so we're very aware of those. But when it comes to thermaling, you know, the main difference is we turn a lot tighter than you guys do, just because we can. It's the exact same. We're trying to map the core and get into it as fast as we possibly can and stay in the core and stay in the best part of the air as long as we can. But when I fly with sailplanes, there's a big race over in Görlitzen every year in Austria, and I'm often in the sky at the same time and watching those guys. And it's the principle is exactly the same. You guys go 1500K and we go 200.
Right. So, yeah. When you guys are flying in heavily trafficked area with sailplanes, is it common to tune into local glider port frequencies and talk to the glider pilots?
Unfortunately, it's very uncommon. This is a great question. I'm glad you asked this. One of my ex-op supporters, a guy named Revis Stephen Gray, and he actually is one of the ones that flies a lot out in Marshall. And he flies with an airband radio, so he's talking to you guys all the time. And he's talking to cockpits and airplanes, and he's talking to the airports. But that's, you know, our radios, our typical radios, are not on those frequencies. We're not on those bands. And so we have club frequencies and, you know, air-to-air frequencies that paragliders use and hang gliders use, but you guys don't. And, you know, it's basically because most of us don't have ham licenses and we're not licensed to operate on those frequencies. And so it's a big missing part of our sport, but pilots who do fly in heavily trafficked areas with a lot of airspace, like in Germany, they would, you know, I would imagine that your sailplane guys in Germany and the pair, you know, when they listen to this, they're like, yeah, of course we do that. But here in the States, you know, FLARM isn't really a big deal yet, and neither are our flying with airband radios. For us, weight is a big deal, and so we don't like to carry things that we don't need to carry, and because most of the time, well, a lot of the time we're hiking the launch, and so adding another radio, it just hasn't sunk in, but it should. It would, but when you're flying in a place like Marshall where there's a lot of air traffic, you know, I think it's an absolute necessity, and all of us should be. It hasn't taken hold.
Well, speaking of gliders and parapilots in the same airspace, how does it feel to be under your canopy where a sailplane is close by and maybe sees you, maybe he doesn't, maybe he's trying to take a picture of you? Have you had this happen?
A lot, and it's awesome. I've never had any problem with sailplane pilots. There have been a couple casualties with midairs, with paragliders and sailplanes in the Alps. I've heard a couple horrific stories. So, of course, you know, you guys are flying really fast, and there is the chance, I think especially cloud flying, that a midair could happen and it would be catastrophic. And the ones that I've heard about have been catastrophic for both. So, you know, it's certainly something that we're thinking about, but I don't know of any paraglider that doesn't love seeing sailplanes. It's awesome. And in my experience, you guys are looking out really well. You've got a big, huge cockpit. You know, you've got a very good view of the sky. You know, I guess where I'd be a little nervous is if I was just directly under, because you can't see us so well then. But the thing there is you're leaving before we have to worry about it. You're going on to the next thermal. So, and then, like I said, typically we're inside of you. You're always circling around us. If we're in the core, that, you know, a sailplane just can't bank that hard. It can't fly in the same core that we're flying in. So typically we're out climbing sailplanes, unless it's just a really big thermal. And so we're usually out climbing them, and it's a pretty brief, hey, how's it going? And, you know, we wave, you guys wave. It's awesome. And you're gone, you know, you're off doing the next thing.
Right.
So I love seeing sailplanes. I wish we saw more of them here in the States. You know, I live in central Idaho where there's a pretty good, event, a sailplane event that happens every year. I don't even know what you call a sailplane event, but it's over in the Big Lost. And, you know, in a day they'll get towed up and fly to the Canadian border and back. You know, it's just awesome. The terrain you guys can cover in a single day is amazing.
Yeah.
So it's definitely on my bucket list.
Aerox, the number one in portable and engineered aviation oxygen systems, your source for FAA-approved oxygen masks and portable oxygen systems, and now introducing the Aerox Pro 2 Plus Flight Bag portable oxygen system. Small, lightweight, and simple to use, the Pro 2 Plus is perfect for the occasional user who wants the flexibility to access higher altitudes without worry about flying impaired. now available at Aerox Distributors and at Aerox.com. So remember, our friends at Aerox, engineered for aviators. Well, speaking of bucket list, paragliding is on my bucket list. So how do you get started in paraglider? What's the usual path between someone that has a dream and then they graduate to a solo flight?
Yeah, from what I understand, I don't fly airplanes, but I have a lot of friends that do, and some, you know, people that are into aviation, you know, often also end up flying airplanes that get into paragliding. So I think it's pretty similar. You know, you would go to a school and you would learn first how to ground handle, and there are great schools all over the world. And, you know, typically the syllabus is theory, so, you know, very basic theory to start, and some of the things we've already talked about, you know, just speed and stall point, and a lot of the things you're going to learn, I'm sure the same as flying a sailplane and also flying an airplane. And so, you know, your basic aviation theory, and then they're going to take you out and you're going to learn how to ground handle. What I mean by that is, you know, with a little bit of breeze or even no breeze, you're just going to play with the glider on the ground, you know, when there's very little risk. So you're not flying, you're just learning how to use the A's, which are the lines that go to the leading edge, versus the brakes, and how to steer a glider and how to catch it from collapsing and handling it when it does collapse. And so you're doing all that stuff on the ground when there's no risk. And it's actually really fun. Ground handling is very fun, and it's a very critical aspect of our sport, even when you're a professional. So, you know, I still spend a lot of time ground handling, and I've been doing this a long time. And so you go out and ground handle, and then you would advance to a really little micro hill if you're in places where there are spots to launch from off a mountain. We could also tow up in flatlands, like in Australia and stuff. You'll learn off the back of a car or a motorcycle, and you'll just get towed up. Okay. So same as you've seen with hang gliders, and same as you guys have, it's just ours would be done from the ground. You're not towing up with an airplane and releasing that way in the sky, but it's just a payout winch where the car will move forward. If there's a lot of wind, you don't even have to move forward, and you go up into the air, you know, hopefully a couple thousand feet, and then you cut away and fly back down. And that's how we often get started for big, huge distance flights too. Like in Texas, is we'll take off from an airport and get towed up, release, and then that's how we start our flight when there's no hills. So anyway, back to the learning, you'll do some very kind of controlled flights. Usually the first flight would be a tandem with an instructor, and they'll just, you know, fly you around the sky for a half an hour, and you can take over the controls and use the brakes. And so same as you would flying an airplane, you know, with an instructor. And then you'll advance to doing really easy solo flights where you have an instructor in your on the radio. And so they're telling you, okay, turn left, shift, you know, weight shift and pull a little bit of left brake. Okay, straighten out. You know, they're basically flying you to the ground on the radio. And then you keep advancing from there. And so there's kind of a syllabus that people follow around the world. There are different protocols and systems, depending if you're in France or Switzerland, but they're all pretty similar. And you're working towards basically your novice pilot's license. So I think same as with an airplane. You can do it in about 2 weeks. Nice. And then when you advance, you know, when you've completed that course and passed the tests, which is both written and the actual flying part, you'll take the practical, I guess that's what it is, the practical exam and the written exam. And when you pass that and the instructor signs off on you, here in the States, what you have is what's called a P2. So that's like a novice license. So you're then signed off to fly solo at easy sites, you have very little skills. You know, you're a total newbie, and you know, you're very much a novice, but you're then, you know, if you buy the gear and you have the stuff and you go fly P2 sites, you can do it totally on your own without an instructor. And then it just goes up from there.
Does that limit you on the wing you can use when you're novice then?
No, it doesn't. It should, but no, you can go out and get a crazy hot competition glider and fly it if you want to. the results of that would probably be pretty terrible. You know, I think most, but I don't think there's any regulation that stops that. And, you know, if you have a bad instructor, then they can sell you bad gear. And there's a lot of discussion in the sport right now. You know, it's done very differently in Europe. But there's a lot of discussion in the sport right now where, you know, our instructors are also selling gear. And so they're maybe incentivized by the wrong thing. And maybe those two things should be very separate, because that is how a lot of instructors make a lot of money, is from selling gear. And so, oh, we'll buy this, you know, buy the next kit.
Yeah,
right. Another kit, you know, and our wings start off as what's called ENA. So that's the certification. And so there's a ton of passive safety in an ENA wing. So that would be a wing that everybody learns on. And then it goes up from there, ENB, ENC, END, and then what's called CCC. So that's the competition class gliders. You know, each one of those is a huge step up in terms of less passive safety and more performance. And so, you know, each one of those steps is obviously harder to recover a glider that's in a situation. And so, yeah, that bites a lot of people getting into gliders that are too advanced for their skill level. And it's pretty unfortunate. Certainly doesn't need to be that way. But yeah, I think I don't know how that, if there's any crossover with that kind of thing with sailplanes, I would imagine. But, you know, it's the same thing with hang gliders. You know, the really high aspect, high performance hang gliders are pretty hard to pilot, from what I'm told. And so, you know, you need a lot of hours, and it's the same in paragliding.
Do you guys have the same division between pure parapilots and powered paramotors? I mean, some glider pilots, they think engines are cheating.
Yeah.
So how's that in the para world?
Well, so paramotors are, it's a really fast growing aspect of our sport right now, which is, depending on how you look at it, pretty exciting. And, you know, I personally find them very loud and pretty obnoxious, and I don't really get it, but I can totally see the value of it if you live in a place that doesn't have very good cross-country potential. They're fantastic for photos and videography, because when you fly a paramotor, you really want to fly it in very casual air. You're not usually seeking out strong thermals and big days like we are when we're paragliding, because we're trying to, you know, fly cross-country. So, you know, they're flying early mornings and late evenings when the air is really gentle and nice. And so it's terrific for photography and videography. But the racing has become a really big deal, you know, where they're kind of like the Red Bull, you know, when they're flying the planes through the pylons, you know, they have a very similar thing in paramotoring, which looks pretty exciting. And then big distance, there's a lot of records that have been broken lately where people paramotor for distance. Is that cheating? I don't know. It's never really appealed to me, because, you know, what's so incredible about the sport is that we're navigating through the invisible, and, you know, we're using forces that are created by the sun and wind and terrain that we can't see. And, you know, that's just awesome. And so I personally don't really get it. But like I said, you know, if you live in Illinois and you don't have a mountain to hop off, and, you know, or it's winter and there's no thermals, then, you know, pretty cool way to still get in the sky. So I totally see their usefulness and why people would, you know, pursue it. And, you know, people do a lot of paramotoring in the Alps, and that, to me, I just don't get it. I don't know why you wouldn't just go paragliding. But yeah, like I said, you know, you can fly down a river at 6 o'clock in the morning. Well, we can't do that. We're going to land in the river. So, yeah. You know, so I totally see. And then, you know, a buddy of mine does a lot of paramotoring, and he's an airplane pilot and a paraglider and a speed pilot. He does it all. And, you know, he'll take his paramotor out in the desert and do this just crazy, beautiful flights, you know, first thing in the morning with the sun just coming up, and, you know, spectacular. So I totally get it from that perspective. It's not kind of a war like snowboarding and skiing was, you know, oh, those guys. I mean, I think we all very much appreciate it. I did some paramotoring in Namibia to try to get some pictures in the dunes in the Susavle. quite a few years back, and it was just a disaster, you know. And I flew it, I flew one once up in Alaska and too much wind, and it was incredibly scary. So I have a lot of respect for them, for sure. You know, it's heavy, it's hard to get off the ground, and they're very awkward. And you know, if you're flying over an ocean or a river, or you know, doing this low stuff that you see them do all the time, and you have a mechanical failure, you're in deep shit. So you know, I do have a lot of respect for them, but it, you know, I think maybe, you know, I understand there's sailplanes now that have a, you know, a motor that you can use in certain situations, you know, to either get off the ground or, you know, make a landing that you wouldn't be normally be able to make. And, you know, they add weight, and they, you know, they hurt your glide, but they can be pretty useful in certain situations. And, you know, I think paramotors are the same thing.
So back to the pure paragliding, when you guys are thermaling on big cumulus days, how do you deal with cloud suck?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's famous stories of cloud suck that have gone really bad. You know, Eva, who I'm actually getting on the show here pretty soon, you know, I'm sure you've heard that story at 2007 World Championships, you know, very good pilot. She was down in Australia, and it was the practice day, and she and I believe a Korean pilot, I've gotten a little hazy on the exact details, but got sucked up into a big QNIM. They were trying to go between two clouds that were kind of growing together, and, you know, clearly shouldn't have been in the sky at all. It was a huge day and way too unstable. And they both got sucked up, and he was killed by lightning, they think. And she passed out at somewhere around 25, 26,000 feet and got spit out of the top of the cloud above the height of Everest, you know, so over 30,000 feet. They know all this because her instruments kept working and it kept track of all this. So she was passed out, got spit out of the top of the cloud, completely encased in ice, her wing, herself, everything. I think she got a little bit of frostbite on her cheeks, and then came back down. You know, the canopy was open miraculously, and came back down, and she woke up somewhere, you know, I think she was out for some longish period of time, woke up and piloted the glider to the ground and was basically unhurt. You know, I don't know about her head so much, but physically was pretty unhurt. And so, you know, there are a lot of stories over the decades of really scary cloud suck, you know, finding a body 40 miles away, completely shattered from the hail. And so it's very much, you know, something that pilots in paragliding and hang gliding learn from day one, you know, to be careful about cloud suck, and, you know, to be really careful flying on, you know, days with a lot of overdevelopment or any overdevelopment, especially here in the Intermountain West where I live, where, you know, a day can change in 10 minutes pretty violently, you know. So anywhere you have dry desert conditions, and strong air, then, you know, it's the same as you guys. So, yeah, I mean, how we deal with it is, I would imagine, pretty the same. We will park ourselves under a big cloud if we need the climb. And as we start to get closer, then you start to look at angles of escape and you know, trying to get on speed bar and trying to start to work the outside of the cloud, so you've got a place to go. But, you know, cloud flying for us is the same as for you. It's illegal. It's very much frowned against and can be incredibly dangerous. And of course, massively disorienting if you're in a cloud, and pretty spooky. So we're actively trying to stay out of clouds. And I think especially beginners often get that wrong. And we'll get into cloud suck, and hopefully it goes okay. And then you don't do it again.
Well, yeah, but, right.
You know, I've been flying an awful long time, and I still have days. You know, I had a big triangle here two summers ago where, you know, I was doing everything I could to stay out of a cloud at, you know, well over our legal limit, you know, which is 18,000, and I couldn't do it. And I got, you know, I still went in the cloud, and, you know, and luckily came out very quickly afterwards, because I had been actively, you know, from 15,000 to 19,000 trying to stay away from this thing. And you know, we don't have the speed you guys do. So, you know, I played it too close that day, and should have given myself more margin.
So how do you get out of the cloud? I mean, do you stall the wing? How does that go?
No, usually in a proper cloud suck situation, if we stall the wing, we'll still be going up. You know, there's still enough canopy over our heads. It doesn't just ball up into nothing. You know, it's just the initial stall will, you know, the wing will go behind you. You'll fall down beneath it. You keep your brakes buried, there's still a lot of glider flopping around up there. And, it's messy, and so you don't have a lot of control. But if, you know, in a proper cloud suck situation where you've got, you know, way over a 10 meter climb, then, you know, you're still going to be going up and pretty violently. And so the fastest way we have to come down is a deep spiral. So a really tucked in spiral. Okay. It's called a spiral dive. You can also do a spiral dive with your outside wing in what's called a big ear, so you can kind of collapse your outside wing and then tuck into a spiral, and that'll give you less G-force. And so tandem pilots do that a lot, so they don't make their passengers sick when they're just trying to come down. They're not obviously flying in conditions like that where they're worrying about cloud suck, but just, you know, when they're just trying to get somebody down to the ground that's not feeling very good.
Right.
So that's our best way. We can do that big ears, what I was telling you about, where you kind of collapse the outside of your wing so only the interior wing is flying, and then use a lot of speed bar. So, you know, you're trying to destroy your angle of, or you're trying to increase your angle of attack and destroy your glide. But you get pretty limited. You can do what's called a B-line stall, where you're stalling the inside of the wing. Your A-lines are attached to the leading edge, and then your Bs. And then if it's a lower end glider, you've got C's and then your brakes. And you can stall the inside of the wing. That's not used very much anymore on the wings we have these days, which are, you know, more, it's called a pyramidal shape. And like I said, the shark nose, it doesn't deal with the B-line nearly as well. And it's not very aggressive. And so you need an aggressive way to come down when you're dealing with a really strong thermal. And so, you know, the best way is to avoid it in the first place. And if you've cut the line too close and you're in it, then, you know, if you've got the terrain below you, I mean, if you've got open terrain below you and you're not going to spiral right into the mountain, then a spiral is really your best option. If you're in the cloud and you don't know where the terrain is below you, and, you know, obviously you don't want to spiral into the mountain, then the best way is just to take a safe heading that you, before you went in the cloud, you identified, okay, well, there's no cloud over there, head in that direction. So you're just looking at your compass because you're totally disoriented. You know, it often feels like the glider's below your feet in those situations. And it's really spooky. And so you would just take a course heading and use maximum speed bar, you know, just go fly as fast as you possibly can and try to stay on that heading, which can be really challenging. It's pretty hard. You often really feel like you're making a turn when you aren't, or vice versa. We don't have all those instruments that can help us out with that. So, hopefully you've got a compass. A lot of pilots don't fly with a compass. And so then you're relying on your instruments, and with the delay of an instrument, you often don't know you're off course until a few seconds too late. And then you're constantly trying to course correct for that. And doing that in a cloud is pretty difficult.
Gavin, that sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's not fun. I mean, I think when you first start getting into it, and you start touching little sides of wispiness and, you know, dancing with the clouds a little bit, it's pretty exciting, you know, when you're going in and out. And as long as you can see the terrain, it's fine. But as soon as you lose the terrain and you're actually in it, and I've been in proper cloud suck. I got cloud sucked up in Alaska on that traverse.
Oh, wow.
where I was really low and I really needed more height to make this valley crossing. So I stuffed myself in a cloud on purpose, knowing that there was no, I didn't have to worry about traffic. I'm in Alaska. I don't have to worry about other planes or anybody else. You know, it was just me. But I flew in this cloud for 20 minutes. And
oh, wow.
When you look back, you know, we've got, I don't know if you guys use Avery, but you know, you can take your IGC file and load it into this software. It's an app online that's terrific. And then you can see your flight and speed it up and slow it down. And I was just I was the opposite of flying one direction. I was just all over the place, you know, trying to use my instruments. I was using my inReach on the compass page, and I had it set so, you know, in power saving mode, so it would only stay up for 20 seconds. And I'm totally frozen. I'm completely encased in ice, and so I'm taking off my gloves and go, okay, stay on the compass. And then I'd get back my gloves on, and then the compass would, you know, and then the screen would die again. And shit. And I knew I was really close to the terrain as well, and so, you know, I didn't want to be going right because that was right into the Denali, and I wanted to stay out to the left towards the flats. But I, you know, when you look at the Avery, I just look like a drunken sailor. I was all over the place, and it was pretty amusing, you know, after the fact. But at the time, I was incredibly disoriented, and like I said, when you're flying a paraglider in a cloud, it's so disorienting that what has happened to pilots is they think they're flying straight, and what they're actually doing is basically spiraling into the ground.
Oh my goodness.
You just totally lose, when you lose your horizon, you have the glider feels like a foreign alien, and you just really lose your sense of direction.
Our longtime sponsor of the show, the Soaring Academy, is engaged in nonprofit outreach work with local area veterans and also with young people for the STEM programs at their top-notch Gliderport facility just outside of Los Angeles, nestled near the north side of the San Gabriel Mountains. They also have a fantastic flight school and are continuing to turn out great glider pilots every month. If you like to donate to their nonprofit initiatives or learn more about their flight school, go to soaringacademy.org or check them out on Instagram at Soaring Academy. Now, you've kind of told us about some flights, but do you have one particular flight that really stands out, good or bad or otherwise?
Oh, man. I have so many. I mean, I've talked about this one before, but I broke a record here in 2013, I believe. It just got broken by the guy in Texas, the one flight I was telling you about. So it was back in 2013, and the day before it actually been a personal best. I'd gone, for me, really far. It was three, and it was just shy of the foot launch record. It was 319K, and I think the record at that time was 325 or something. It was 204 miles, and wow. I landed at, you know, 202 miles, and so I was just shy the day before. And you know, this was here in Idaho, and it was a day I flew off Mount Baldy, which is our big ski area, and flew really deep into Montana. And it was a big week. I had three flights, and they were all, you know, over 300K. And so I got home that night, actually to a friend's house who lives down valley from me, at 4 something o'clock in the morning, and got a couple hours sleep. And he was actually taking me home the next morning, that morning, and I was going to bed. I was exhausted. And two of my friends were up on the top of Mount Baldy getting ready to launch, and called me and said, "Hey, we think today's even better. You should come up here." And I don't know. I'm tired. But my buddy had a bottle of oxygen I could borrow because mine was empty from the day before. And went and got a sandwich and got on the gondola and went to the top. And they had already flown. They launched and got kind of unlucky, and they got clouded out. It was a big day. There was a lot of overdevelopment that day. I hadn't even looked at the forecast, but you know, I learned as I got into the air. It was, you know, there's a lot of verga. It was a big day to be flying in the mountains. Kind of a sketchy day. And I launched quite a bit late and got into the air, and within the first hour, I realized, wow, I'm on an incredible pace here, because it was really windy. And like I said early, wind is not that safe for us, but there was a lot of wind, and most of the wind was up high. And so if I could stay high and out of the terrain, then it was relatively safe. Twice on the flight, I got really low once in the Lemhi. So our mountain ranges here are, we're in the, what's called the Wood River Valley. And then we, as we're heading east into Montana, we cross three main, well, four actually big mountain ranges heading into Montana. We go over ours here, and then we go over the Big Lost, and then the Lemhis, and then the Beaverheads, which is the Continental Divide. And as I was going into the Lemhis, you know, before, when I left the Big Lost and I was gliding towards the Lemhis, it's a big valley crossing. It's about 20 miles, and which is a big one for us, not so big for you guys, but it was, you know, you got to stay high doing that. You know, I was hitting 110, 120 kilometers an hour, you know, oh, with on a glider that's got a trim speed of 45. That's a lot of wind. And it was like, man, yeah. But it was smooth and beautiful. But as I got into the Lemhis, I started getting pretty low, and I turned into the wind, hoping I could soar the windward side, which was also the sunny side in the morning, and just immediately got blown over the back. And so, you know, it was ripping on the ground as well, well over 50K an hour. So well above trim speed. So incredibly sketchy, very dangerous situation that, you know, a lot of it was ignorance back then. I was still, you know, for big air and big distance, I was pretty new to that game. And so I was terrified then, but now I would be really terrified. And I'd like to think I would never put myself in that situation. It was way beyond safe. Anyway, got blown over the back, and it was just, we call it SIV, situations en vol, which we've practiced for over the water in kind of a controlled setting, you know, so forcing our glider to have problems and then correcting them in a safe where you got an instructor on the radio and you've got reserves and you can just land in the water and get picked up. Well, this was that, but in a totally uncontrolled situation. So I was completely in the rotor of big mountains, very, very treed on the backside, and just hanging on, just doing everything I could to just keep my glider over my head. And then got to kind of a ridge. I was able to, you know, I lost a ton of altitude, got kind of on a ridge that was in the rotor, but also on the windward side. So it was on the backside of the Lemhis, but it was just a canyon down there. And I was just, you know, skimming the tree tops that might, when you look at my IGC file, I was less than 15 meters off the ground for a big chunk of this. And so, but it was so windy that I couldn't figure out how to land. You know, it was all treed, and there was a couple little pockets of places where I felt like I could maybe put it down, but I would have been behind trees, and it was just terrifying, really, really scary. And so I was still just kind of hanging on, trying to figure out how to put it in and not get blown over the back of this mountain safely. And an eagle came out of a tree and just skied out, just poof, you know, and I went to where he was or had just been and got a ripper thermal. You know, it was like a 12 meter climb, and lost one side of my wing, but that didn't matter because the thermal was so strong. And I went to 16,000 feet in what felt like seconds. It was just
wow.
And really, really strong conditions. Like I said, it was pretty dynamic that day. And anyway, got back up to Cloud Base and kept going. Later on in the flight, just past Butte, Montana. So I'm way in now. I'm about the same distance I'd been the day before, but on a totally different route, kind of heading up towards Helena, Montana. I actually didn't really know where I was. And the sky, I'd been running from this Virga line all day, you know, this big Virga line behind me. I'd been kind of keeping pace with it all day. And it started just out in front, had been beautiful all day, just cloud hopping. We call it dolphin flying, when the clouds are just, you're just totally in sync with the thermals. You know, I'd leave a climb and I'd start going down, and then the next climb would appear before me and make a cloud, and I'd be perfect position. And so, you know, I think my average speed that day was 54K an hour, which is the kind of speeds you see flying the flatlands of Brazil or Texas. You know, that's really, really fast for us. Wow. That means you're not spending a lot of time climbing and you're getting blown downwind. And again, just totally unreasonable in a mountain environment. It was sketchy, but anyway, it was also beautiful and at times just wicked. And anyway, I got past Butte and the whole sky just completely grayed out. This Virga that had been chasing me finally caught up to me, and it grayed out. And I went from almost 18,000 to the deck. And I was ridge soaring. Basically, I just got in front of this cliff, and I was just, because it was still very windy on the ground as well. And I was just basically ridge soaring, and it was really dark. And I'm looking at my distance going, God, I'm 10K away from the record. It's right there. I started thinking, like, man, if I could just leave this cliff edge and fly downwind down there, I had a little bit of terrain in this valley off to my left. And I thought, God, if maybe I could make that 10K if I just wanged it into the valley and flew downwind. And right when I started thinking, okay, I'm going to try that, a little pocket of sun came out, and it was, like I said, it was so unstable that day that just poof, I caught a little bit of a climb and was able to hang with it. Got back up to cloud base in no time. And it was basically that last glide was what killed me. Was there's a Canyon Ferry Lake was out in front of me, and I could see that this storm was going to catch me. I wasn't going to be able to keep outrunning it. And so I flew another 70K or so on that one glide, which is pretty remarkable. Awesome. And then landed at the lake at a little campground, and it was 387K. So it was 240 miles. So it was a pretty good, you know, I beat the record by a pretty fair distance. And I was just over the moon and, you know, landed safe. And my buddy who had flown that morning and said, hey, I think today's going to be even better. He'd been chasing me all day, driving 100 miles an hour. And he showed up 2 hours later. So, I mean, I totally smoked my buddy on the ground who was driving really fast. And yeah, it was pretty special. I think it was a 16-hour drive back.
Oh,
and the
wow.
flight there was just over 7 hours. So it wasn't even that much time. I mean, you know, in a good summer day, we often fly 10, 11 hours, but that was just, you know, a lot of wind and very special. And, you know, that record held for 8 years. And so it was, that was pretty fun. I would never want to repeat it, anything close to that, but, you know, I was happy to have survived it. And, you know, it was a very special line that I've never flown since. You know, that's the cool thing about free fly is every single flight's totally different, you know, and yeah, I've never flown that line since.
Now, we were talking earlier, you said you're getting ready to do a hike and fly in Dubai, right?
Yeah, I was. I just pulled the pin on that yesterday. So there's a big hike and fly race, mostly ex-Alps athletes in Dubai that I was going to leave for here in a week on the 18th. And it's, I think, 4 or 5 days of racing. So you race one day and you have a day off. I think the first day we do 2 laps on this 7-star hotel, this real fancy hotel, and wow. lob off the top and fly down to the beach and then run back up the, you know, it's a huge hotel. It's a very fancy, the hotel with the hole in the middle of it. You've probably all seen pictures of it. It's crazy. But yeah, I'm actually building a house right now, and all the schedule just got shifted around, and we're pouring the foundation next week. And we were going to be doing that in December. So everything, anyway, I can't attend, unfortunately. So I've just canceled that yesterday, but I'll be watching it online for sure. It looks like a lot of fun. I didn't know there were mountains in Dubai, but apparently there are.
Yeah. I do want you to briefly mention, I mean, I could talk about this for hours, but when I was checking out paragliding years back, I'd actually run into the Alps X. Now, you've competed in that, right? What, 4 times? Is that correct?
Yeah, this was my 4th. Yeah, my first. It's a race that happens every 2 years, and it's basically a 12-day hike and fly race across the Alps. And forever, until this year, it started in Salzburg, which is near Red Bull headquarters, and ended in Monaco on the sea in the Mediterranean.
Oh, nice.
And so you basically stay with the spine of the Alps. And then every edition they've always added distance, made it harder. And there's always iconic waypoints along the way, like Mont Blanc and Monte Rosa and the Matterhorn, places like that, and that you either have to hit on the ground or in the air. Yeah, and it's vicious. They call it the hardest adventure race on earth. It's a mind-blowing amount of endurance and groundwork, you know, so either hiking or running and then flying. So it's a combination of, you know, your own personal transport. You had to carry your gear the whole way. You have a support team that can help water you and feed you and strategize and give you weather reports and all that kind of thing. And so it's very intense for your team as well, because there's very little sleep. And you're basically just going hard for 12 days trying to get there. I think it has an 11% finish rate. So,
oh, wow, 11%.
Very few people in the history of the race have made it. I made it in 2015. I haven't made it since, but yeah, this was my fourth one was this summer in 2021. I think five people made it this year. So it's usually 32 people start. Whoever's in last place every 48 hours gets eliminated.
Wow. So
there's usually another, 20% get eliminated just because of injuries or overuse injuries, whether that be blisters or something broken or, it's pretty hardcore.
Yeah. What I saw on YouTube, I'm just, of course, getting a snapshot of it, but it looks super extreme. And you have to, I'm sure, train pretty intensely before you even think about competing.
Yeah, and that's actually why I've decided to not do another one. I'm bordering on 50. Some of the guys in the race, if you added them up, they don't the two of them together don't add up to 50. So, I'm definitely the older guy there. Although there was a Japanese guy who's done a bunch of them. He did it in 2009, Ogi, who was 61 this year, and he put on a hell of a race. So,
oh wow,
maybe I'm quitting too early, but yeah, the training is. The training is intense. It's something that is, in some ways, the flying aspect of it is a lifetime, which I got into later than a lot of the guys that are big contenders in the race. But the physical aspect, they say you can either, pay during the race or you pay in the training. And, I always decided to take it as from the training side, because if you train really hard, the race is annihilating, but you can enjoy it and it doesn't just rip you apart and you feel strong at the end. But it requires a pretty solid year of training really hard, unbelievable amount of hours and dedication and diet and, everything that goes into it. I do a ton of strength training. I spend a lot of time in the gym, but also just, you've got to get your body, pretty comfortable with doing a lot of miles on concrete. You end up doing a lot of walking on roads, and often very busy roads. And so most of the time you're just going up, you're just going up a mountain to get to a launch and flying. But, in the mornings and the evenings, and if you bomb out in the middle of the day, you've got to spend some time on the concrete as well, which is pretty hard on joints. And it's especially hard because you're carrying your gear the whole way. It's not super heavy. It's about 20 pounds, but that adds up to metric tons over the course of the race. So, you got to spend a lot of time strength training and just preparing just for the pack, just, your core strength and your back and your shoulders and then just the overuse stuff. Blisters are what takes out most people. And you can just imagine, especially if it's hot or if it's wet or there's a lot of rain. You've got to keep your feet dry, got to keep swapping socks and shoes. And there's a lot that goes into it, because it's 12 days. It's 12 days of going really, really, really hard.
That is insane. The only thing I can even try to compare to, I go run, right? So I'm running an hour, but you guys are out there literally day and night. It's not like you can go to the hotel, right? And rest up and go the next day. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. You're in the old days, you were allowed to go 24 hours a day. You didn't have to stop ever, except when you're just exhausted. The new rules, which they implemented about a decade ago, is, you're not allowed to move between 10:30 at night and 5 o'clock in the morning. So, that's not a lot of rest, 17 and a half hours every day where you have to go really hard. The pace of the race is unbelievable these days. Everybody in it is super fit and really good pilots, and they have amazing teams. So the tech has gotten super advanced and the speed of the teams is absolutely remarkable. And so then one night in the race, you can pull what's called a night pass and go all night. We're all dealing with pretty serious sleep deprivation, especially as the race starts getting into day 8, day 9, day 10. And you're flying a paraglider, which is pretty dangerous. So, yeah, it's a pretty vicious combination that's very addictive, really fun, and it's an amazing place to be for 12 days. And I mean, physically where you are, what you're seeing, what you're doing is amazing, but also just where you are in your brain it's pretty special.
Wow, takes a whole different kind of person to do all that. So wow, that's awesome. Good for you.
It's been a fun journey.
Oh, I can't imagine. Wings and Wheels has been serving the soaring and sport aviation community for over 30 years. They hands down have the largest and most comprehensive inventory of sailplane and soaring supplies in North America, and they ship globally. Nearly everything you'll find on their site is in stock and ready for same-day shipping. Wings and Wheels is the exclusive American representative for HPH sailplanes. Be sure to check out the Twin Shark, their latest launch. The team has thousands of hours of flying experience in gliders and airplanes. Staffed by Adam, Kelly, Julie, and Sean, a friendly voice will answer when you call or email them. Check them out at wingsandwheels.com. We always give pilots a chance to give a shout out. So this is your shot to give a shout out to anyone you'd like to, who's helped you along your way and your soaring journey.
Gosh, there's so many. Well, first would be my wife and my daughter. They are really good about allowing me to pursue this passion. You know, there's been no breaks on my life or handrails put on the things I do, because this is what I've always done. And so shout out to them for sure. Maddie and Fallon, you guys are awesome. My ex-Alps team, they are, a couple of them have been with me since the beginning. My trainer, Ben Abruzzo, and Keith, and Revis. And this year we're joined by a guy named Ben Horton, who did all the media for us, and just incredibly solid group of dudes. And love you guys. You guys are amazing. And then, of course, I owe thanks to all my mentors, all the people who have, you know, been there for me in this sport and given so much good advice over the years, and the folks I fly with on a regular basis. And then, of course, my sponsors, Niviac, Cortel, Patagonia, Saleva, Vespa. It used to be Garmin. I lost those guys this year, which was a bummer, but I still love you guys. They've all been very integral in allowing me to pursue this. And this year, Smartwool was an amazing addition. Kept my feet blister free. So thanks to you guys for making awesome socks.
Gavin, you know how I got to know you is your podcast that I'd been listening to for a few years. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Cloud-Based Mayhem. This is, let's see, our seventh year, I think. We just posted our 158th show, normal show, and we also do some bonus shows. But it's basically, a podcast dedicated to free flight. And we have more paragliders than others, but we try to, you know, we'll do, if you fly it, we'll do it. So sailplanes, balloons, wingsuiting, base jumping, hang gliding, paragliding. So the theme of it is I basically talk to the best pilots in the world and try to distill and spread that knowledge. So how to stay safe and how to fly far. But we do shows on acrobatics. You know, there's basically two disciplines in our sport, acrobatics and cross country. And so, yeah, I just have these fireside chats with great people and try to bring it to people who are interested in free flight. I just published my first book, Advanced Paragliding, that's all based on the talks of the first 100 shows. So
nice.
At some point, I think when we get to 200, we'll have to do another one based on those. But it was kind of the best of the best of those first 100 shows was put into a book that was published by Cross Country Magazine, who I write a regular column for, and all good friends of mine over in England. And so, yeah, it started on a complete whim in the beginning. The sound was terrible and we were very, you know, there was no schedule, and I would just get around to it every once in a while. And I found that, you know, the people who listened just said, oh my God, I've been aching for this. You know, we can't get this kind of information, a deep dive with, you know, great pilots in a magazine or a book, or it just doesn't exist. And so, yeah, just we kind of started on a whim and it's grown into a pretty cool animal, and I love doing it. But
that's awesome.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for having me on your show. It's a real honor.
Yeah, thanks for bringing our two sports together. This is pretty awesome.
Yeah, I think there needs to be more cross-pollination there. I think that I'm sure we know some things that soaring pilots, you know, haven't been able to tap into, and vice versa, I know is big. You know, I know that the way soaring pilots look at the weather and the sky and the forecast, and just because of their machinery, what they're able to do, and their glide difference is, you know, and speeds is massive. And it's, you know, we can't go fly and wave. We actually can. You know, one of my buddies who flew in the 2015 X Alps with me was very convinced he was flying and wave one of the days, a very rowdy big day. So we can, but not very safely. Whereas you guys seek it out, and so, you know, it's pretty exciting. And you know, like I said in the beginning, the principles are the same. So I'd love to explore it more.
Well, hopefully we'll be chatting more in the future.
Love to. Thanks, Chuck.
Hi, everyone. Sergio from Soaring Master here. Today we're going to talk about how new technologies are making cloud flying a lot easier and what to do in order to use them in a safe way. Once restricted to commercial or military aircraft, attitude and heading reference systems, or AHRs, are now easily available for gliders. Even electronic variables have them as one functionality. Even though these systems are more than welcome to soaring, they cannot be seen as a game changer in terms of cloud flying with sailplanes. In fact, a pilot trained to fly into clouds needs to be able to control the sailplane by using a simple turn and slip indicator, the airspeed indicator, a compass, GPS, and altimeter. The AHRS is a plus, and a great plus, by the way. But not the only thing to be relied upon. If it fails in the middle of the cloud, what would you do? There are also inherent risks related to cloud flying. Sailplanes are not equipped with heated pitots or ice-protected surfaces, so both the airspeed indicator or the altimeter can eventually ice up. The sailplane performance and stability can be degraded due to icing as well. Not to mention the possibility of instrument failure during IMC. So the pilot must closely monitor the instrument's coherence and sailplane response, looking for any sign of these problems, so one can act as fast as possible and get out from the cloud in a controlled way. Things are much more complicated than just enabling the AHRS function and going into cloud. From the piloting perspective, cloud flying requires full reliance on the instruments and total disregard for body sensations and external visual cues, as they might lead to pilot disorientation. When cloud flying, pitch is indirectly controlled via speed control with small inputs to maintain speeds within a predetermined range. And since sailplanes are spirally unstable in roll, this means that if left alone, the sailplane will slowly bank and enter in a high-speed spiral dive. Quickly recognizing this condition by looking at the instruments is the key, and not taking any body sensation into account. You also need to monitor your position via GPS, mainly if you fly near airspace borders or over mountainous regions, and you always need to have a plan for any circumstance. Checking the sailplane flight manual is also important. There you will find whether cloud flying is authorized by the manufacturer or not, the minimum instrumentation required and specifications, flight limitations, and any other manufacturer recommendations. The flight instruments themselves also require a double check by the pilot. Not every turn and slip indicator can be used in a sailplane. They need to be calibrated to the flight speeds we fly in sailplanes. Also, a good understanding about the functioning of this instrument is required. Turn and slips can show unreliable indications depending on the G loading and other factors. The first thing any pilot willing to fly into clouds must do is to look for a cloud flying course, which will provide you with both theoretical and practical training. And also check the local regulations, because they can vary enormously from country to country, and it's even forbidden in some of them. So having the endorsement and being fully qualified for cloud flying does not mean that you'll be able to do it everywhere. If you don't have this kind of training, simply do not enter in clouds. If you are near the cloud base and realize that you will enter in a cloud, simply open spoilers and get back to visual flight conditions. If you inadvertently do get inside the cloud, level the wings, centralize commands, open full spoilers, and maintain this until getting out from the cloud. Flying inside the so-called white room is a different game, and in order to do it safely, A number of things and training must be done before attempting it. See you in the next episode, and don't forget to follow me on Instagram at SoaringMaster or check my website, soaringmaster.com.
Thank you, Sergio, for another great informative Soaring Master segment. And a big thank you to our guest pilot, Gavin McClurg. Don't forget to check out his YouTube channel and his Instagram. You can find some links there in the show notes. You're going to see some pics and videos of a lot of his adventures he shared with us today. If you have a soaring adventure and you want to share with us, you can go to our website and record a short story on our recording tool. It's super simple. Until next time, stay healthy, stay safe, and happy soaring.
If you would like to say hi and let us know where you are enjoying the podcast, we would love to hear from you. If you are a glider pilot and want to share your aviation journey, contact us at chuck@soaringthesky.com or send us a message on our website at soaringthesky.com and Chuck will get in touch with you. We hope you join us next time for another soaring adventure here on Soaring the Sky, a Glider Pilots podcast. Soaring the Sky is written and produced by Chuck Fulton, co-producer Mitch Thompson. Original music for the podcast was written and produced by Kim Spangler. Graphic design for the podcast was created by Zachary Fulton. Voiceover work was done by Michelle Perez.